say like Hardline, for example, you're saying Hardline has a, for lack of a better word, insulating factor or, of a, say like 120 decibels. How would you go about actually measuring that? Back to you.
Yeah, that's a pretty good question, Joe. And when it comes to something like Hardline, there's three places where a leakage could take place. Place number one is the input connector. How well is the input connector bound to that shield, that outer conductive cylinder of the Hardline? And is that contact making contact around the full 360 degrees of the circumference of the connector? And is that a real good bonding of milliohms? And I really mean it, milliohms and maybe hundreds of microohms. So you could be getting leakage right at the connector, the input connector, and the output connector. Now, particularly with braided cable, not so much with hardline, but with braided cable, there always is a certain amount of leakage along the length. And how would you measure that? I am guessing the way it has been done, there's probably a mil-spec procedure for this, where you start off with a known extremely well shielded signal generator and hopefully an extremely well installed connector at the input end of the cable and a very well installed connector at the output end of the cable, which goes into an extremely well shielded 50 ohm dummy load. Now you put a lone known amount of power down that cable, and now you put very sensitive sensing devices that you walk along the outer braid of that cable. It could be a halfway dipole, or it could be a small current sensing loop. There are various ways of calibrating that test equipment. The whole thing could be put into a screen room. I said screen room, it would be an anechoic chamber-like screen room in which you substitute various kinds of transmission line. You might use as your standard a very well-known brand of double-shielded hardline.
Repeater, timeout.
So between that signal generator and that very well shielded dummy load, you put something that you know is extremely good at shielding, and you calibrate your test equipment. Then you plug in the cable of under test and find out how much signal that you measure. The leakage of a coax cable is probably going to be measured in, dBc per length would be the units. In other words, each foot of the cable, for a known amount of power going down the cable, each foot of the cable is going to leak a certain number of microwatts of signal. You know that Andy DeBatu CDL has been using this kind of leaky, intentional coax cable made by the Andrew Company. I can't think of the name of that stuff right now.
Called Radiax.
That's it, Radiax. So by building Hardline, where you have periodic holes drilled into the outer shield, where you have a known leakage rate, and that leakage rate for a known amount of power going down the cable is some number of microwatts per foot. And as you run that cable down the length of your subway station, your platform, a certain number of microwatts leaks out of the cable, and therefore an MTA law enforcement person standing there with handy talkie is in full communication by way of that leaky cable. Well, as you can tell, as you start making the holes in the cable smaller and smaller, further and further apart, you're eventually getting down to the point where it's at least as good as braided cable. All braided cable has a certain degree of leakage which can be rated. It's not an easy rating to do because most things that leak, let me drop it. The leakage comes from a particular point, like the interface between the connector and the cable. But in the case of braided cable that has a very minuscule braid and lots of gaps in the braid, and we're talking about microwatts per foot. That's not the units they use. I'm trying to simplify it here. And that microwatts per foot would only be for a known number of kilowatts going down the cable. The real units probably are dBc per foot or dBc per meter. But there are ways of rating that. W2RYY. K2RY is up in the tick net. You got it, Joe.
Okay, very good. So even cable like half-inch heliacs, which is basically a closed copper jacketed cable, being it's half-inch heliacs, 7/8 heliacs, whatever, you're telling me that there is some signal that does leak through that that jacket from the inside to the outside of the cable, excluding the conductor connections?
The answer is absolutely yes, but you got to be careful how you use the information. The world's very best anechoic chamber, arguably, is the one that's set up at Edwards Air Force Base. It originally was called the AFAF, Air Force Anechoic Facility, and eventually became the Benningfield Anechoic Facility because this very well-respected pilot named Benningfield died in a B-47 airplane, I think it was, the flying wing, the Northrop flying wing, and he died near Edwards Air Force Base. So this anechoic chamber, where the walls are made out of quarter-inch thick steel plate. All of those plates are welded together, and all the welds have all been tested for any voids in those welds. So quarter-inch steel, thick steel plates, where the finger stock on the door has got a double layer, if you know what I mean. That chamber is rated for 100 dB tempest-proof. That is to say, you built the chamber as best you can build it. And if I take a very sensitive AM radio, listening to a signal at 1010 frequency, 1.01 megacycle, so to speak, and I walk inside that chamber and close the door, there is a measurable amount of signal that comes from the outside world inside of that chamber. No matter what you think your shield is, an extremely good shield can hit numbers like 120 and on rare occasions 130 dB. A completely perfect six-sided metallic box. Let me drop it. As a shield, with no input and output connectors and nothing penetrating the wall, you put the right kind of battery-operated instrumentation inside that six-sided box where all of the edges are perfectly soldered, welded, whatever. You will measure a signal 130 decibels weaker. Whenever you generate a radio signal, it goes to every single cubic centimeter of this universe. You can't stop it from doing that. The only thing left to discuss is when the signal gets to the point you care about. Is it above the threshold of the instrumentation you're using? You start off with a strong enough transmitter on the outside of the box, a sensitive enough receiver on the inside of the box, where the receiver is narrow enough in bandwidth and it integrates for a long enough period of time, where the signal can now listen, where your receiver can now receive a signal that is, let me pick a number, minus 160 dBm, and I've worked on things like that. So you've got minus 160 dBm of sensitivity inside the box, and you've got a kilowatt outside the box. Kilowatt is plus 60 dBm. So the difference between the sensitivity of the instrumentation inside is 160 plus 60, 220 dB. You've now got instrumentation that I've just described that has 120 decibels of shielding requirement capability of measuring. You do that test, you're going to find the signal. There is no perfect shield. We can talk about this shield is 20 dB better than that shield, but once you've created a radio signal, it finds a way of getting there. It's being attenuated like crazy for every thousandth of an inch of the copper on the outside of that shield. It's being attenuated like crazy, but it never goes to zero. Let me drop it. Once you generate a radio signal, no matter where you're talking about, it never goes to zero. It gets weaker and weaker and weaker, and you need more and more heroic techniques to measure that signal, but it's still there. It goes to every cubic centimeter of this universe, inside of every shielded can, inside of every screen room you have ever built. Ain't that crazy? W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, great explanation, thanks. I thought it was an interesting subject to bring forward on the TechNet. Okay, back to the TechNet.
with the receiver you are using at this time, so to speak, and you don't measure the signal, you say, hey, I killed the signal. You never killed it. You knocked it down X number of dB. It might be 15 dB below the threshold of your particular receiver. That signal is still there. That little Voyager spacecraft out there transmitting roughly 10 watts from something like 8 billion miles away. It's 120 astronomical units. Pluto is 39 astronomical units. This thing's 120. In other words, it is 3 times the distance to Pluto, sitting out there transmitting this QRP signal of 6, 10, whatever it is, watts. And you use a 240-foot goldstone dish with a parametric, with a Mesa amplifier in the front end. You listen to that signal and you hear what Voyager is saying to you. And the round trip time is something like 37 hours. You say hello to Voyager, and 37 hours you get an answer back. Yeah, I hear you. And here's my new information. At the speed of light, 36 or 37 hours round trip time. And because of the inverse square law, every time you double the distance, the signal must get 6 dB weaker. And boy, there's a lot of doubling of the distance by the time you get out there, 120 astronomical units, something like 8 billion miles. Something like 17 hours one way at the speed of light. The average person will say, no way in hell are you going to hear that signal. The answer is absolutely. Just use the right equipment. A 240-foot diameter dish, which is what? An acre and a half of antenna with the most sensitive receiver in the world. You're going to hear that signal. KC2WGB, K2RIW. What kind of challenging questions have we got this week, John?
Dingus 375 still operating.
I'm checking on it right now, yes. I'm hearing my voice coming out with some delay out of 375. Go for it, John.
Very good. KC2WGB. All right, we have a thank you letter, an email here, thanking the TechMed for your explanation on antennas, and just go for it, try it. So what this gentleman did, he has a landlord that does not want any transmitting antennas on his roof. But he had a turnstile up there on a 5-foot pole, on a little tripod. And what he did, following some of your instructions, let me let it drop. Is he made a couple of shorting bars. This is a turnstile antenna for FM. Okay, he made a couple of shunt bars, which he could slide along those 290-degree folded dipoles to shorten them up. He also changed 300-ohm wire to 50-ohm, and he put a T at the antenna, he hooked up the antenna, and on the other part of the T that had an open fitting, he placed a piece of 50-ohm cable, and he started to snip. And watching his antenna meter that he has, and he wound up tuning that thing for 2 meters and did it very well. After he was complete, he changed it over to a 10-foot pole, so he has it up another 5 feet. He's getting out beautifully. And what he found was he disconnected the 50-ohm stud he put on, and he put a 75-ohm stud just to try it, and he started trimming that. He also tried some air variable capacitors. They did not work well. But he found out the 70-ohm worked well when he trimmed it. He wound up with a 1.4 to 145 to 147, fairly flat. Above and below those frequencies, it tapers off a bit, but he wants to thank you for the information which allowed him to do that. He's getting out terrifically, and he'd just like maybe if you had some comments or maybe something else he could try. So over to you, Dick, and see if you have any comments. KC2WGB.
I'm not positive, but what I think is going on here, and by the way, let's give this person a name. Does this person have a name like John?
Bill. His name is Bill.
Okay, what I think Bill is doing is he's doing an extremely interesting experiment on quarter wave or half wave or shorted or open stubs. In other words, if I have an antenna of any impedance in the world, my antenna might be 5 ohms, 50 ohms, 500 ohms, might be highly capacitive, highly inductive, whatever. One of the pieces of the magic of transmission line is that if I start off at the antenna and I walk back from the antenna toward the receiver or toward the transmitter, just the right number of wavelengths, And if I hang just the right amount of stub reactance, in other words, I put in a T connector, I've got the straight through line going between the antenna and my receiver, we'll say, and off to one side I've got this third connector on the T connector, and now I put either a short or an open circuited piece of transmission line there, and we call that a stub. Let me drop. If I am smart enough, and if by some magic, or by cut and dry, but by some magic, I knew the exact impedance of the antenna, its resistive component and its reactive component. Once I know that, and if I understand transmission line theory, there are a number of discrete locations along the transmission line between the antenna and the receiver where I can hang a T connector and a stub, and the stub of just the right length will make all standing wave ratio disappear between that T connector and the rest of the line all the way down to the receiver or the transmitter. It's hard to believe. You can have a huge amount of mismatch of the resistive component, a huge amount of mismatch because you've got a reactive component, and that combination, that really yucky impedance of your antenna. As long as you're smart enough, there's a couple of discrete locations along the transmission line, close to the antenna, where you hang a stub, and all of it goes away. Let me drop. Now, 99.9% of the time, the thing that you hang there called stub, it's a length of transmission line that's either at the far end open-circuited or short-circuited, and there's at least two different solutions. That is a reactance. It's either an inductor or it's a capacitor. With rare exception, it is never a resistor. Even though you've made the stub out of 50 ohm or 70 ohm or 120 ohm transmission line, because of the way you're using it, it is a very high quality capacitor or a very high quality inductor, and you can change the magnitude of that capacitor or that inductor at that frequency. You gotta be careful now. The stub is frequency sensitive, but at your favorite frequency, you can make everything perfect. Your next question is going to be, how do I know what reactance I'm getting out of that stub? There's a fairly simple formula that'll tell you that. Let me drop. And the answer is X equals Z0 tan theta. I'll repeat that. X equals Z0 times tangent of theta. Z0 is the characteristic impedance you're using for the transmission line you're making the stub out of. Tangent is the trigonometric tangent. Theta is the number of degrees of length of the stub if the stub is a short circuit. So if it's a short-circuited stub, X equals Z0 tan theta. You know that if I made the stub exactly 90 degrees long, the tangent of 90 degrees is infinity. Therefore, if the stub was exactly 90 degrees long, even though it's short-circuited at the far end, at the input end, you will see an infinite impedance by that formula. It becomes an open circuit. This is the more exacting way of telling you that every quarter wavelength of transmission line is an impedance inverter. A short becomes an open becomes a short. There's a similar formula for using it as an open circuited stub. And I think it is, instead of tangent, I think it's the, let's see now. I think it's cotangent, I think you're right. So if it's an open circuited stub, X equals Z0 cotangent of theta. And you'll notice that the X, we didn't call it X sub C or X sub L. And you're about to ask why not. It is X, it's general. In the case of a short circuited stub where the formula is X equals Z0 tan theta, when theta is less than 90 degrees, that stub is always an inductor. Let me drop. So I could modify the formula and say X sub L equals Z0 tan theta if and only if theta is less than 90 degrees. However, if theta is between 90 degrees and 180 degrees, is it 90 and 180? Let me think about that. I think it's so. Between 90 and 180, the tangent is negative, and therefore the X becomes a negative reactance. That's a fancy way of saying capacitor. So I could say X sub C equals Z0 tan theta if theta is greater than 90 and less than 180 degrees. So by choosing the right length of the stub and making the stub either short-circuited or open-circuited, and know, when you know what you're doing, you can now correct anything. You'll notice that because Z0 is in that formula, if I, for instance, wanted exactly 90 ohms of inductive reactance, I know that the tangent of 45 degrees is 1. Let me drop. So if my stub was 45 degrees long, that's a fancy way of saying it's an eighth of a wavelength long electronically, including its velocity factor. So if my stub is exactly an eighth of a wavelength long, then the reactance of the stub will equal the impedance of my cable, because tangent of 45 degrees is unity. If I used 50-ohm cable, I would have a 50-ohm inductive reactance. If I used 70-ohm cable, and it's exactly an eighth of a wavelength long, I would have a 70-ohm inductive reactance. So as you see, I can make the stub out of any cable I've got. I might have to readjust the length a little bit to come back to the same amount of inductive reactance. But if I've now chosen an impedance matching procedure for my antenna, where I want a shunt inductor at that location, and I make a short-circuited stub, I can make it out of 70-ohm cable, 40-ohm cable, 50-ohm cable, 90-ohm cable, just readjust the length accordingly, and I'll get exactly the amount of inductive reactance that I desire at that location. The nice thing about a quarter-wave shorted stub made out of, let's say, for instance, RG8 cable, is that it can tolerate very large amounts of signal. Let me drop. Assuming that my RG8 cable at my frequency region is capable of tolerating 1,000 watts of power, I now can make a stub that will work in a kilowatt transmitting system. You try to build a 50-ohm capacitive reactance that you're going to hang directly across a transmission line to do impedance matching, and that transmitter is running at 1,000 or 1,500 watts, that would be a very beefy capacitor. That would be either an extremely large, high-power capacitor, a transmitting rated capacitor, or it better be an air capacitor with great big air spaces between the plates to make sure it doesn't arc over. If I was doing it with a fixed capacitor hanging in a shielded box on that T-connector, I'd have to be very careful how I choose that capacitor. If I make the capacitor out of a piece of RG8 cable, or if I really want to get enthusiastic, I make it out of a piece of 50-ohm hardline, Andrew Heliax. That simple piece of transmission line can easily tolerate that power without arcing over. And you didn't have to do anything expensive. So stubs, once you know what you're doing, stubs can create a lot of impedance matching magic, among other things. Put the right arrangement of stubs with a number of key connectors along your transmission line, and you can build a band pass filter, a band stop filter, a notch filter. You can notch out one signal by passing another. You can do all kinds of fancy things. So what you call filter might not look like a filter at all, and it might be a kilowatt rated filter. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech band.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Well, Bill was listening to us many times, and he keeps hearing about how you can hook up these antennas and all of these adapters and LC networks. It seems that you could tune anything to a frequency, and that's what gave him the reason to try. So he originally had that fed with a 300-ohm wire. It's a 300-ohm antenna, but after he was through and used his antenna meter, he got it to work very well, and he's transmitting beautifully with it. So he just wanted to thank you for the information and let you know that it's worth trying. There, so as a stealth antenna, the landlord accepts it because it's an FM antenna. No transmitting, but he's got it going and really good. Let me let it drop, and I shall go on to the next one.
In the case of twin lead, 300-ohm twin lead, for instance, an open wire line, where you don't have a convenient T-connector you can put there, can you still build a stub there? Absolutely. You just cut through the insulation on your open wire line, your 450-ohm ladder line, or your 600-ohm open wire line, and you hang another piece of open wire line at right angles at that point, make it short-circuited or open-circuited, make it the right length, and you can build beautiful stubs in open wire line that can give you perfect impedance matching if you know what you're doing. Perfect impedance matching, filtering, to be a band pass filter, a band stop filter. It can be a compound filter that passes one frequency and stops another. Your particular transmitter may be putting out some second harmonic. You could hang the right kind of a stub on your open wire line that kills the second harmonic and passes the fundamental with absolutely no insertion loss. And now for the second harmonic that used to come out of your transmitter has just been killed, if you know what I mean. KC2 WGB, K2RIW ProtectNet.
Great stuff, Dick. And this is his first attempt. It took him 4 days to get it tuned up and all, but he's very happy with it. So, again, he thanks us. Very good. All right, now I'll go on to the next one. Let me let her drop. Okay, have a question on a divider or combiner. It's a question. If he has a combiner and he needs a combiner, he'd like to make a change to the one he has. It's a 50-ohm combiner, one in, two out, two-port combiner. So it's a 3 dB loss. He'd like to know, is there a way to modify that so he can have 50 ohms in, one at 50 ohm out, and another one at 75 ohm out, and what would it entail to do that? Over to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
If you were starting from scratch and you knew what you were doing, can you build a structure inside of a box that's got three connectors, where input connector number one is the common connector at 50 ohms, and the two output connectors are either equal in power or unequal in power at any ratio you desire, and could those two output connectors be 150 ohm and 175 ohm? Absolutely. Yes, there are ways of doing that. If you were starting from scratch and building that power divider. But now that you own a power divider, that's a beautiful shielded structure with three connectors, one input and a pair of equal power outputs at 50 ohms, can you make one of those 75 ohms externally? Absolutely. Let me drop. And by the way, if the thing you're feeding on one of those output connectors is 75 ohms and your power divider is rated for 50, and you just simply slap the two together, in theory, that is a 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio. In theory, you're losing 2/10 of a dB because of that impedance mismatch. We're talking about very minor effects here. However, if you happen to be building a state-of-the-art system, a moonbound system, where you need every microwatt of signal you can get off of that receiving antenna, because the signal that reflects off that moon is the weakest thing you've ever seen. That moon has got 261 dB of loss on 432 megacycles between what you transmit to it and what you get back. 261 dB. In other words, even if you've got kilowatts of transmitter and a 400 square foot transmitting antenna at 432, 16 Yagis on 432, the signal you're going to get back is just barely above threshold of a state-of-the-art receiver on the average day. So therefore, you might want perfect impedance matching to get full performance out of the low noise amplifier. And therefore, you might want to match 75 ohms exactly, even though you got a 50 ohm port coming out of your piece of equipment. Let me drop. So to convert 50 ohms to 75 is relatively easy. Multiple ways you can do it. One is a so-called quarter wave impedance matching transformer. In other words, if from the 50 ohm output connector that's going to your 75 ohm receiver in this example, if you put exactly a quarter wavelength of cable that's at the geometric mean impedance, it'll give you a perfect impedance match. What does that mean? You take 75, multiply it by 50, take the square root. I don't know the exact number, but it's probably something like 63 ohms. I've got a calculator here. Oh, I'll do that calculation in a minute. Assume it was 63 ohms. So if you had a quarter wavelength of 63 ohm coax between the 50 ohm connector and the 75 ohm receiver. And by the way, maybe you're not mounting the receiver that close. Maybe you've got a 10 foot length of 75 ohm cable going over to the 75 ohm receiver. but in that short length that comes out of your power divider is where you put this quarter wavelength of 63 ohms, in my example. It'll give you a perfect impedance match at that frequency. So you take the output impedance you desire, the input impedance you got, multiply the two together, take the square root, that's the impedance you want. Let me drop. Let's assume that the calculation is 63.5 ohms. The next question is going to be, where the hell do I buy 63.5 ohm impedance coaxial cable? And the answer is you build it. You take whatever diameter of copper tubing you like as the outer conductor. You go to the K&E display that's in your hobby shop where they sell you pieces of brass tubing of every diameter you can think of in increments of a 32nd of an inch. You choose the right diameter of copper tubing to act as the center conductor. Now you've got the right ratio of outer conductor and center conductor that gives you 63 ohms. You put that together as a mechanical structure, make it a quarter wavelength long. It's now a piece of air coax cable, 63.5 ohm impedance in my example. And now you've got a perfect impedance match between the two. That's one of a number of solutions. That's the simplest one used by most radio amateurs that have to get a perfect impedance match one frequency at a time. Your next question is going to be, how fast does it degrade? If you're doing that at 432, with that quarter wave impedance matching device that I just described, let me drop. And you tuned it at 432. There's formulas I could tell you, you can go to, they'll tell you exactly what you're going to get. But I think you're going to get a darn good impedance match, everything between 420 and 450 when you tune it at 432. It's not a narrowband approach. It's a reasonably broadband approach. I wonder if that comes close to what you think he's asking for, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Absolutely, Dick. It's better than I thought because now he does not have to worry about modifying the existing combiner that he has. Okay, so he can pick up that product, and I would assume he could either do that up with whatever the connectors are, their end connectors, that would be rigid enough to hold the sender. But if not, he could make that up with some sort of spiders inside, correct? Maybe a Teflon?
At almost any of the VHF frequencies where we're likely to do this, the total length of that structure is so short that everything being suspended in air just by the connectors will have no trouble holding itself together. You won't need any other kind of support structure. By the way, the geometric mean between 50 and 75 ohms is 61.24 ohms. So, and by way of the formula, you know how to calculate the impedance of a coax cable in air. I think the number is 176 log of A over B, where A is the inner diameter and B is the outer diameter, or vice versa. I think it's 176. So you tell me the inner diameter of the outer conductor and the outer diameter of the inner conductor, and you take the ratio of those, take the log, multiply, I think it's by 176, and now you know the exact impedance of that cable. And you hang those two pieces of tubing in between two type N connectors, B and C connectors or whatever, inside of a box, or you could actually hang them in air. In other words, the connector itself is what is holding everything together. Your next question is going to be, hey, I got 50 ohms input, I got that going into a 50 ohm connector, and the output is going to be 75 ohms, but I don't have a 75 ohm connector. Don't worry about it. Use a 50 ohm connector on the output. The connector itself is a half inch long, which is a 20th of a wavelength at your frequency most likely. That's an extremely minor perturbation. And if you want to be a stickler, you can recalculate the impedance perturbation that the connector makes, a 50 ohm connector connected onto the end of a piece of 75 ohm cable. You can calculate, once you know the inner dimension, the length of that connector, you can calculate exactly what it does. Therefore, you can readjust the length and diameter of the K&E tubing in order to compensate.
Repeater, timeout.
You can compensate for all the 375 came back. You can compensate for all of that if you want to be a stickler and get everything to the nearest milliohm, if you know what I mean. So everything that you think is inexact in this process, there's ways you can force it to be exact at your frequency. You have the tools to do that. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. Just have to learn how to use those tools and those formulas.
276 log SD.
You think it's not 176? You think it's 276? You found that in the book, Barry?
Just kind of remembered it.
I think it's 176 and 3 something or other for twin lead, but I'll have to look it up. But, however, in the Radio Amateur's Handbook, the right page is going to give it to you. The reference data for radio engineers is going to give it to you. You simply Google the word impedance of coaxial cable, and they will give you the formula. So the fact that I've made another one of these mistakes is not a showstopper. Let me drop for a second. I want you guys to realize that every realistic engineer does not bat 1,000. We all have a certain error rate, no matter how sincere, no matter how hard you try. A certain number of things you're going to do are going to be an error. You being a good engineer of high integrity, you're going to put forth a sincere effort to lower your rate of errors, but you're going to make errors. And if you've got any reasonable brain, you're going to periodically recognize you've made the error, admit it, and laugh at yourself and say, boy, I was dumb on that one. I'm not going to do that one again. There's a kind of engineer that I have met who will never admit he has ever made an error. He will say, you think I said such and such. I really said so and so. I was really meaning such and such. He'll weasel word out of everything, and he thinks he's got a 100.00% accuracy rate. Nobody does. So you got to be realistic here. Also, there are people who have listened to the TechNet. There was a particular man who now lives in Europe, who was living in the United States for a while, and he had listened to the TechNet for something like 2 years. After a year and a half, he started shouting at us, hey, you guys are repeating subjects. I said, oh, yeah? I mean, this is TechNet number 1,535. It represents something like 6,000 hours of TechNet. 2 years ago, a guy asked a question on standing wave ratio. This week, another guy asked a slightly different question on standing wave ratio. And yes, to some degree, that subject is a repeat. You mean to tell me we're supposed to keep track of everything that you have listened to make sure that none of your time is being wasted, that you never hear a repeat? The guy...
Repeater, time out.
The guy literally said, I'm never going to listen to the TechNet again because you guys keep repeating subjects, you keep making mistakes, and you keep doing things that I don't like listening to. The price is right. He's getting all this for free. And to complain about such things is a little bit foolish. After 6,000 hours of talking, there's going to be some repeats. You can quote me on that one. There's going to be a whole lot of repeats. You play back some of the recordings of 3 years ago, some of the recordings of 2 years ago, and some of the recordings of 1 year ago, with a slightly different slant, and sometimes more accuracy, and sometimes less accuracy. There's going to be repeats. There is no choice. There's a hell of a lot of information to the stuff we call wireless engineering, radio technology. And certain portions of it are going to be a repeat. I hope you can tolerate that. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, it doesn't pay to talk to an engineer who never made a mistake, because if he didn't make a mistake, I don't think he did too much. That's my experience anyway. You're absolutely right. Let me see. What else was I going to bring up here? That covers that pretty much. And I'm sure he's going to be happy because now he doesn't have to really change that combiner. I think that's a doable item. Okay, I'll let it drop and I'll go on to one more.
There is one caveat to what I just told you. If those two output connectors have to go to some complicated piece of test equipment where you want phase matching of those two output signals, because we've now plugged in this quarter wave impedance matching device on the line that starts off at 50 and ends up at 75 ohms, you've now impedance matched. That's the good news. And by the way, the number is 61 point, I gave you that number before. 161 and a fraction ohms is the geometric mean. You've added an extra quarter wavelength of line. It created a 90 degree delay of that longer line. And if those two signals, even though they're on different impedances, must be phase matched, it isn't very difficult to take the transmission line coming out of the 50 ohm connector that goes to the 50 ohm piece of equipment and make that line another quarter wavelength long, and now you've brought the back, you brought the two of them back into phase match. So simultaneously getting impedance match and simultaneously getting phase match, you've got the knobs on the equipment to do that, if you know what I mean, as long as you know what you're doing. KC2WGB, K2RAWV, John.
Yes, I believe that would work perfectly. No problem. Oh, by the way, I know one question he's going to ask. What about the 3 dB loss per output? Is that going to change in any way?
Absolutely not. The way a usual 2-to-1 power divider is made, it's called a Wilkinson half hybrid, is the way it's usually done. Internally, if you look to what's in there, you've got the input common connector that goes to a pair of 70 ohm transmission lines that are each a quarter wavelength long. That in turn goes to the two output connectors. And between those two output connectors, there is a 100 ohm resistor acting as an isolating device. Under normal conditions, when you're playing this thing forward from the common connector to the two output connectors, there is 0 volts across that resistor, and the resistor is dissipating no power. And you can call it 3 dB of loss. In other words, if I measured the signal strength of the signal going into the common connector and measured the signal strength coming out of each one of the output connectors, there will be a 3.01 dB of loss, even if the thing is perfect. It isn't loss. It's power division. It's conservation of energy. If I take the two output signals and recombine them with another power divider used backwards, I'll come back to the exact same power again. It isn't real loss. We call it apparent insertion loss because you've divided the power, each one gets half the power, and that's a 3.01 dB loss. Let me drop. And if this thing is made for a pair of output 50 ohm loads, and if it sees a pair of 50 ohm output loads, it will do a perfect impedance match, half 2-to-1 power division. Even though one of those output connectors is ultimately going to a 75 ohm receiver, because you put that impedance matching device in there, the quarter wavelength, quarter wave impedance matching transformer, you've converted the 75 ohms of that receiver into 50 ohms when sensed right at the connector of the output power divider. So the power divider doesn't know that one of the things it's going to is 75 ohms. It thinks it's feeding a pair of 50 ohm loads because of what you've done. And even if you didn't put in that quarter wave impedance matching device, if one load really was 75 ohms instead of 50 and the other is 50, you're now going to be developing an extremely small voltage. Let me drop it. An extremely strong differential voltage across that 100 ohm resistor. You're now going to be getting a little bit of insertion loss. But if you actually study that, there's ways you can do it. I am guessing that the total power loss because of what you've done with the impedance mismatching is going to be something in the vicinity of 1 or 2 tenths of a dB. And there's going to be a slightly different power. The 75 ohm receiver is going to get a very slightly smaller amount of power compared to the 50 ohm device. But if you did nothing to correct the impedance, the differences here are rather minor. Unless you're doing something really exacting like moon bounce, or you're doing laboratory instrumentation, 95% of the guys doing this wouldn't even bother putting in the quarter wave impedance matching transformer. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Very good way to look at that. Correct. So if we have an input of whatever it is, we just have divided, we're dividing that in half. So each port is putting out the same amount as what's going in. So there really is no loss to speak of. Okay, very good. I'm sure he will understand that with no problem. That's nice the way that works out. Okay, I'll drop and go on to the next one. Okay, this one concerns radar. A young gentleman who's reading about radar, and he also knows a little bit about sonar. And as we've spoken before, we have the thing called prop signature ID with sonar, and being able to tell exactly what ship is where and stuff like that. He'd like to know if that's possible with radar. Maybe not airborne because of the difficulty in the size of the equipment, but in ground-based radar, can they identify a particular aircraft because of some signature with radar so they could say, okay, that's plane number 123, and when another one comes through, even though the radar cross-section looks the same, they can identify that as 124. So maybe you could speak about that.
Easy, but the answer is yes. If an airplane, like a fighter, F-15, is coming right straight toward you and you're aiming your radar at it, the input compressor blades give you a particular turbine whine, is what I call it. They've got a fancier name for it. But if you've got the right kind of a receiver processing network, that you look at the nature of the echo you're getting off that airplane, you will be able to tell the difference between the whine you get off of the compressor blades of an F-14, an F-15, a B-1, and so on. They all have a characteristic signature. That's one thing that's characteristic. There are some others. If your radar has complete polarimetry processing, where you look at the magnitude of the horizontal signal versus the vertically polarized signal, and the circular polarized signal, clockwise and counterclockwise, you do enough processing of that, with reasonably high probability you'll recognize the signature of aircraft A versus aircraft B. Turns out there's a lot of information hidden in that echo. Polarization, amplitude modulation, in some cases even harmonics that are being generated by the joints of the aircraft itself. So I didn't say it's easy, but yes, there are ways. Just to give you another example, let me drop it.
About the ISF transponder.
Yeah, the IFF transponder is something that the FAA has you put on your aircraft so that you identify an extremely specific airplane. That is a Boeing 747 serial number so-and-so. And the transponder is there to make sure that you've got additional information painted onto that radar screen of the FAA controller. And that transponder is spitting back things like altitude of the aircraft. So you not only know where the aircraft is, you know what the altitude is. So even though you're watching two blips on that screen look like they're going to crash into each other, by way of the altitude difference of 2,000, 5,000 feet or whatever, you know that they're not going to crash into each other. So that intentional transponder gives you additional information, but it's spitting back on another frequency. The way John asked the question, he's really asking, on the frequency of the radar, is there additional information? And the answer is you do.
Question.
Hold on a minute for a minute, though, Wes. Now, in the case of surveillance reconnaissance receivers that are doing very sophisticated processing, where you're intentionally looking for residual modulation of somebody's radar, every radar comes on the air, and there's a certain amount of phase shift, amplitude shift, chirp, and whatever, at the leading edge, during the pulse, and at the trailing edge. There is a spectral signature of almost every radar. If you've got the right kind of processing equipment, you can recognize that spectral signature. In some cases, you'll recognize the spectral signature of a particular transmitting tube. As such, if somebody has got a portable radar and he moves it from city A to city B overnight, and you now fly your airplane near his territory and you're measuring that radar again, you'll say, hey, I recognize that signature. It used to be at city A, now it's at city B. Or correspondingly, he's still back at city A, but now he's got a different signature. Oh, I know that he just changed the final tube of that transmitter because the new tube has got a slightly different characteristic. There's a lot of hidden information in radar signals. In 2XJM, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, that's puzzle, but I got lost. Harmonic produced by aircraft. And I got lost in the interaction. So you have a signal that is sent by the radar system, and then first origin of the harmonics. and the interaction of the harmonics versus receiver bandwidth. Enter a shield.
Whenever you transmit a signal to some metallic object that is made out of individual plates of metal that are riveted together at those joints, NASA calls them MIM junctions, metal intrinsic metal. For instance, in the case of the 240-foot dish of Goldstone dish in the Mojave Desert of California that was listening to the Apollo astronauts, and they're transmitting on frequency A and receiving on frequency B simultaneously, full duplex, the exact frequency in the case of Apollo 15, because I know I listened to Apollo 15, is 2287.5 megacycles downlink frequency from Apollo to the ground, 2106.4 megahertz uplink. And the 2106.4 uplink was something like a 10 kilowatt transmitter, making sure that the astronauts were getting a really potent signal, that even if the front end failed, they'd be able to hear it. And on a windy day, as the wind blows that dish and the individual plates of the dish are grinding against each other, the 2106.4 signal at 10 kilowatts was making spectral side lobes that fell at 2287.5, the downlink frequency. You listen to some of the reception of Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, and on a windy day, you'll hear bursts of static caused by the metal plates of the dish grinding against each other because of the wind moving them. Call it the rusty nail phenomena, call it what you like. You've got a joint that is slightly nonlinear at the RF frequency. It is generating side lobes, generating harmonics, generating all kinds of things. The so-called rusty nail on a tower alongside of a repeater can create quite...
Repeater, timeout.
Let's see if we've got... Okay, 375 just came back. So, a rusty nail alongside of a repeater can create havoc. A friend of mine once did a test where he wanted to measure the quality of his station master antenna. He was going to mount it on something in the backyard. He said, hey, here's a fence post. And he screwed it down to that fence post. The fence post happened to be holding onto a chain link fence. A chain link fence is a zillion metal junctions all rubbing against each other. On a windy day, when he transmitted into that antenna and he tried receiving on the repeater that he connected to it, the receiver sensitivity was tremendously weaker than he expected because of all of those metal junctions of the chain link fence moving against each other on a windy day with a nearby antenna. So metallic objects that have discontinuous chunks of metal rubbing against each other in the presence of an RF signal will generate all kinds of other signals. It's the exact same phenomenon that generates passive intermodulation distortion, which is an extremely difficult test that every antenna on every cell site must meet. And if it doesn't meet 150 decibels of suppression of passive intermodulation distortion, if your cell site antenna doesn't meet that spec of 150 decibels of PIM, passive intermodulation distortion, suppression, you will be dropping cell site calls. You will be desensing your receiver. The guy with his cell phone in his hand transmitting a signal back to you will be falling below the noise of the PIM noise being generated by the transmitters on your cell site because of the imperfection of those antennas. I didn't say this is an easy concept to understand, but any metallic object rubbing against another, you could hold two screwdrivers close to the receiving antenna of your receiver. You got a 2 meter receiver listening to a relatively weak AM signal. FM, because of the suppression of the limiter, you might not see it. But if it's an AM receiver, and you're listening to, say, a 2 meter signal, and you've got the antenna in the shack with you, and you put these two screwdrivers in front of your antenna, and you rub those two screwdrivers against each other, in the AM reception, you will hear a scratchy noise that you are generating. And that's just a receiver. There's not even a local transmitter. The transmitter that's sending that signal to you is 20 miles away. and just the two screwdrivers rubbing against each other is making a modulation of the impedance of that antenna because it's in the near field of the antenna. Ain't that crazy? And 2XJN, K2LIW.
Yeah, I'm trying to see if there is anything deeper than that. There are two separate questions. One of them is you have now an aircraft, and the aircraft is made out of the plates, and those plates would then create any kind of different phenomena. But now, from the receiver standpoint of the radar, this phenomenon may simply not feed into the bandwidth of the receiver. Now, as far as the two screwdrivers, well, I'm thinking about you're talking about the near field. If there was a transmitter, then we would say, okay, we have an E field, and we're playing with the E field alteration. As a magnetic field, doubtly, we do that. But now we have a receiver, and I confirm, yes, you're right. Now the transmitter is 20 miles away, and now we have a receiver. We don't have a near field any longer. Because, because it's a receiving antenna. But it's not an active antenna, it's a passive device. Good question. And I think you're going to give me the good answer. At your field.
Yeah, assume I'm listening to a medium amplitude 2 meter signal. Somebody's running key down on the transmitter. He's transmitting no audio. On my horizontally polarized coat hanger wire, three element Yagi antenna, I'm receiving that signal from him. And 1 or 2 feet in front of that Yagi, I'm holding two screwdrivers at right angles to each other. And I start rubbing those two screwdrivers against each other. In that AM reception of that receiver, I will hear a scratchy noise. What's going on? Those two screwdrivers, as they rub against each other, are periodically making good contact and bad contact as the two chunks of metal are scraping. Periodically, there's a micro-ohm of impedance between the two. Periodically, it's a milli-ohm. Periodically, it's 5 ohms. It's all happening in milliseconds and microseconds as I scrape these two screwdrivers against each other. When the two screwdrivers are making a micro-ohm of contact between the two, I've now got a certain length of metal in front of that antenna that's disturbing the impedance of the antenna in a certain way. A millisecond later, I've got 2 ohms of contact resistance between the two screwdrivers instead of 2 micro-ohms. I've now got a brand new length of metal in front of an antenna that's got a brand new reactance at 2 meters. I am modulating the impedance of the screwdrivers that are in front of that antenna. The antenna is therefore hearing an amplitude of signal that's jumping up and down. It's only jumping up and down a fraction of a dB, but a good AM detector into the loudspeaker, you're easily going to hear that scratchy noise. That's a beautiful example of the so-called rusty nail phenomenon. The fact that the transmitter is 20 miles repeater.
Time out.
The fact that the transmitter is 20 miles away doesn't matter. I am modulating the impedance of the nearby antenna. If I hold those two screwdrivers 10 feet in front of the antenna instead of 1 foot in front of the antenna, I'm probably not going to hear the scratchiness anymore. If I did that experiment, and I'm scraping these two screwdrivers against each other, and I keep increasing the distance between the front of the antenna and the direction toward the transmitter, I keep increasing that distance, the scratchy noise I get will get weaker and weaker because I'm now exiting the reactive near field of that antenna. I'm first going into the near field, then the far field. Eventually, I'm so far away that my ability to modulate the impedance of an antenna is becoming so minor that I don't hear the scratchiness anymore. It's still there. It's just below the threshold of my hearing. And maybe it's below the threshold of the signal-to-noise ratio by which I'm listening to that signal.
And understand it differently. The scratchy screwdrivers create an extension of the active element element of the Yagi antenna. In other words, it's like an extension of it. At the same token, if you were to do the same with one of the elements